Hi, everybody. Welcome to our Elder Law debrief for October. Those of you that have not attended one of these presentations before, what my goal is to get you as much information on what's happening in the elder law world, including relevant cases and then some elder law news. As much information as we can pack into the next half an hour is kind of my goal. So I do tend to go quickly. So buckle up for those of you haven't been on this before. We also provide an interactive agenda that's part of the materials in the materials bar there on the right. And don't forget to complete the survey at the end of today's presentation. We take those very seriously, and it really helps guide our education presentations. So for those of you that don't know who I am, my name is Jim Wolverton. I'm the Director of Legal Education here at Krauss Financial. This is our Elder Law debrief for October of 2024, probably the last one before the end of the year, and then keep the antenna up for next year's first one, which will usually be in the first quarter of each year. So we try to do these around quarterly, and then we'll keep providing you information throughout the year through our webinars as well as our CLEs. So this is just one of many of the presentations that we provide here at Krauss Financial. So if you haven't already visited our website and signed up to receive those notifications, please do that. So without any further ado, I will let you know a little bit about us. We are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we do that through utilizing specialized insurance products, Medicaid compliant annuities being the most popular resource that our attorneys use to help their clients, resources as well as support to help attorneys streamline the process of advising clients planning for long-term care. And you can see there we have the depth in staff and professionals. We handle a lot of cases every month, and lots of experience to help you and your clients out, getting them qualified for Medicaid as quickly as possible. So with that, we'll start off with some elder law cases. I will admit to you that there wasn't a whole lot of Medicaid-specific qualification cases in the last quarter since the last time I did an elder law debrief in July, but I was forwarded a great case out of Iowa that deals with real estate installment contracts as a strategy for Medicaid planning. So we did include this case in your materials. It wasn't reported because it was just a county court case, but it's really helpful to kind of see what some of these other strategies outside of the Medicaid compliant annuity need to look like in order to become non-countable resources for Medicaid eligibility. So what we'll be looking at here is the Faith Lubbers versus Iowa Department of Health and Human Services case. And so we'll start with the case facts, and we'll go into the holding. So Faith Lubbers applied for Medicaid in December of 2023. Her application was denied as the agency claimed she was over-resourced. The decision was appealed via interagency appeal. The issue on this case is whether the department erred when it determined that a certain real estate that Faith Lubbers owned but was subject to a non-transferable, non-assignable real estate installment contract should have been a countable asset for Medicaid eligibility. So the ALJ in this case concluded that under Iowa law, the resource must be available. So when I teach beginner Medicaid planning, I always say, in order for a resource to be available, it has to be under control of the applicant and be able to convert to cash, and they can pay for their own resources. And under the Iowa Administrative Code, that's pretty much what it says. It says the application to be considered available, the resource is available under the following circumstances. The applicant owns the property in part or in full and has control over it. That is, it can be occupied, rented, leased, sold, or otherwise used or disposed of at the individual's discretion. The applicant and the applicant has a legal interest in the liquidated sum and has the legal ability to make the sum available for support and maintenance. So that follows very closely with the federal statute regarding what is a countable asset. And the department's regulations specifically provide that a property sold under an installment contract for a price consistent with its fair market value is exempt as a resource under the Iowa Administrative Code. So the ALJ looks at this and says there's not an indication that the installment contract price was inconsistent with the property's fair market value, and the contract follows all the rules and has all the limitations built into it, so she should be eligible for Medicaid assistance and facility care. All right, that should have cleared things up, but we all know what Medicaid agencies do. They don't like losing. So the department, they take that ALJ decision and they go up to interagency department review. And you can imagine what happened there when we get it up above the ALJ's head. They say, well, we're going to overturn that ruling stating that the property is available if the applicant has a legal interest in a liquidated sum and has a legal ability to make the sum available. Just quoting the code. Okay, we'll apply that to the case. And here's the department's stretched reasoning. It says that it's a four-year term, and if the payments aren't made, it could be canceled. And so the applicant holds title until that term, so she still owns it, even though it has all these limitations on it due to this properly drafted installment contract. So the applicant files for judicial review. Let's get it out of the agency and into a judge's hands that hopefully can apply the facts of the case to the actual administrative code. One thing I wanted to highlight, though, as we go through these cases moving forward, is what kind of deference are judges giving to these agencies now that the Raimondo decision has come through and the Chevron deference has been wiped out on a federal level through the Supreme Court? Are the local courts going to be a little bit more hesitant in giving agencies that deference as they have been? Usually this is part of the case I just kind of skim over really quickly because it always says agency gets the deference unless there's a clear violation of administrative code. But here I just wanted to highlight the way that the district courts looked at this. I believe this was probably briefed before that case came out, so it probably wasn't brought up, but it says here that the district court acts in an appellate capacity to correct errors of law on the part of the agency. The courts are required to give deference to an agency interpretation of law when the agency has been clearly vested with authority to interpret a provision. If the legislature has not given the agency clear authority to interpret a provision of law, the courts may reverse the interpretation if erroneous. Here, the department's not claiming it's owed any deference regarding its interpretation at issue in the case. So here, that's not an issue, but I do want to highlight that as we move forward and kind of see how local state courts are handling that issue now that Chevron deference got wiped out with the Raimondo decision. So back to the kind of the point here is these installment contracts, how are they handled? The court holds that the Medicaid Act is a federal aid program designed to help the states provide medical assistance to financially needy individuals with the assistance of federal funding. Participation is voluntary, but if a state decides to participate, it must comply with all federal statutory and regulatory requirements. This is kind of a difficult concept to boil down into one sentence. I think they did a really good job there. Lubbers contends that she converted the farmland she had an interest in into income for purposes of Medicaid eligibility. This was not improper, and she followed a procedure that was specifically authorized by federal law. So if we look at 42 U.S.C. 1396 PC1, and that's an I, not an L, it's just the way this font makes it look. There are provisions in there that say how a real estate mortgage contract have to be restrictive. And so upon review, the court looks at the restrictions in the federal citation there, and what that states is the repayment terms have to be actuarially sound, have equal payments, and no balloon payments or cancellation upon death is allowed, and it is prohibited within that contract that we were looking at there. So the court concludes that the interest in the installment real estate contract was not a resource for Medicaid eligibility purposes under federal law and has been supported by at least three federal circuit courts that were provided by the applicant in their brief. The same conclusion is reached under the state law's definition of availability. Here we look at the record and we look at this real estate installment land contract, and it's clear that the Lubbers lack control of the property in the sense that she cannot transfer or otherwise dispose of the property in her discretion because of the non-assignability and the non-transferability provisions of the contract. So she no longer has control over this property, so she can't go sell it. And the agency's point that she has the right to dispose of the property if the contract is breached was not persuasive. Rather, the focus is whether Lubbers possesses the present right to control the property, and she does, or whether she has the ability to retain and dispose of the property in her discretion. And the court concludes here, the answer is clearly no for both of those questions. So in this case, because the installment real estate contract was properly drafted by a very good elder law attorney that knows the rules, the case was upheld here, and that particular resource was a non-countable resource. So a great case for the attorneys that were helping get this application through, get Ms. Lubbers qualified for Medicaid benefits. Those of you that look at this on a national level, Iowa is one of those states that attacks everything. So it's nice to hear that our Iowa friends in elder law got a win up at the county court level. We'll see what happens with this case moving forward. Okay, so to be honest, that is all of the Medicaid planning cases I was able to come up with for this particular stretch of time between our last webinar and the next one. But there are some really interesting cases that delve into other parts of law that you might run into. So this is where we're kind of going to go into the first year of law school world with some of these cases. So the first one is a criminal case regarding elder abuse and how restitution awards are made by a sentencing court. So I thought this was a really interesting case. Came out of the Supreme Court of Kansas. And so it's the state of Kansas versus Alonzo Union. Alonzo Union met Jean Miller in 2007. They became friends and moved in together, sharing their rent. After Miller began to suffer from dementia, Union acted as her caretaker and was authorized to use Miller's bank account in 2014. He also became her durable power of attorney. Miller then moved into a nursing home called Riverbend, and then left, but she left a bill of around $9,000. Union set up a payment plan with the nursing home, but then stopped making payments after a few months. Miller moved back in with Union after leaving the nursing home. Riverbend, the nursing home, called DCF and said there's a potential abuse case here or neglect being committed by Union. Katrina Ratcliffe, the social worker at DCF, opens up an investigation. She talks to both Miller and Union, looks at the finances and says, hey, something's fishy. She goes and gets an emergency guardianship and conservatorship to protect Miller and her finances, and then reports the case over to the criminal side. So in November of 2019, Union pleads no contest to the criminal charge of mistreatment of a dependent adult. So now we've gotten into the criminal world, and he pleads no contest to that criminal charge of mistreatment of a dependent adult. However, before sentencing on that case, Miller passes away. So at that restitution hearing, we don't have Miller's direct testimony. What we have is Ratcliffe, who did the investigation, and she testifies into the finance situation. She says Miller received income from Social Security and pension, and some of that money in Miller's account was used to take care of utilities, like it should be. However, she also said there was around $30,000 of ATM cash withdrawals that were made by Union, and then there were other resources also used for Walmart purchases. So there's cash taken out and then taken over to Walmart. Money orders were made there, and we don't know what happened to that money. There were some other expenses that she was able to dig out, including liquor, YMCA, Postal Service, several purchases in Minnesota, a dating website, expenses at a casino, Men's Warehouse, and a shoe company. Jean Miller's a woman, so probably a lot of those weren't for her, especially at Men's Warehouse. So Ratcliffe testifies she could not specifically account for $30,000 of the ATM cash cash withdrawals, but so she had to presume that money wasn't spent for Miller. And when she asked Union about that money, he said he spent the money on the house but never provided any receipts, and he's not sure what was purchases at Walmart. The investigator then asserts that Union owes the amount to Riverbend at the nursing home First Day because at the time he was Miller's durable power of attorney and he signed the admission paperwork. So as a grand total, she claims Union owes the entire income figure missing, over $52,000, plus the nursing home bill for a grand total loss of over $60,000. So Miller comes back and he says, well, yeah, some of those expenditures weren't used for Miller, but some of them were used for her at the house and the food. The Walmart's fund were money orders or cash used to pay for her car and payments for debts that she already owed. And the reason why he went to Minnesota, he took her car several times to use her money to pay for gas and register the car in Minnesota. So he also explains he paid rent with her money and utilities. And this is where things start to go a little fuzzy for our friend Union here. He can't provide any proof because the rental company that he rented the house from, they moved and they don't have a new phone. So that's really not a great excuse for where the money went. But anyways, Union acknowledged he owed Riverbend for the stay, but the reason why he stopped making payments because there was a $900 extra charge on that bill. He didn't understand why there was an extra $900, so he just stopped paying them altogether. And he also acknowledged that as a durable power of attorney, he has a duty to keep records on how he used her money, but he lost all those records. So Union doesn't, he's not real good at record keeping. We'll just leave it at that. The good news is here is we had a final witness of Miller's niece who visited when Miller was living with Union. She felt Miller was well cared for and wasn't too worried about her financial and emotional stability. The court ordered that Union pay $31,000, which consisted of half. That's kind of where the court was like, okay, we're going to make a restitution amount of around half of the ATM withdrawals and Walmart expenses and then add on the debt to Riverbend and some other miscellaneous expenses. That's part of the criminal sentencing. You have to pay that restitution back as part of your criminal sentencing. Union appeals that, and the panel affirmed the restitution award. So the Kansas Supreme Court takes this case up on Union's petition. And Union says that the restitution order should be vacated because the amount owed to the nursing home was not caused by the crime of his conviction, and that there was insufficient evidence to support the district court's restitution award of half of the Walmart purchases and ATM withdrawals. So Kansas law, when you get into sentencing, says that the court may include a defendant to pay restitution, which shall include but not be limited to damage or loss caused by a defendant's crime. The court's determination of restitution must be based on reliable evidence, which yields a defensible restitution figure. So we look at that Riverbend amount, and basically the court comes back and says that a causal link between the defendant's crime and the restitution damages for which the defendant is held liable must satisfy traditional elements of proximate cause, cause in fact, and legal causation. This is where I was like, oh, I learned this stuff in law school many, many years ago. So cause in fact requires proof that is more likely than not that for the defendant's conduct, the result would not have occurred. And legal cause limits the defendant's liability even when his conduct was a cause in fact of a result by requiring the defendant is only liable when it is foreseeable that the defendant's conduct might have created a risk of harm and the result of the conduct and any contributing causes were foreseeable. So it requires proof that the conduct would result or would not have resulted but for, and it's a foreseeable result of that. If you took the bar exam multiple times like I did, you had to memorize that. So Union argues that Riverbend was not damaged by his conduct in committing the crime for which he was convicted. The crime he was convicted for was mistreatment of a dependent adult, which is defined by taking the property or financial resources of a dependent adult for the use of the dependent or another. The for proximate cause to exist, the specific crime must have been the but-for cause of Riverbed's damage. Here, there's no evidence that shows that Union's crime of conviction, which was the mistreatment of a dependent adult, caused the nursing home bill or caused the bill to go unpaid. Rather, that was caused because she had an independent need for care. His crime and the unpaid bill are two independent and unrelated events. The portion of the restitution direct to Union to pay Riverbend was then vacated. So that's much more of a civil act, and that's not going to be included in the criminal restitution order. Okay, so Union comes out on top of that. He doesn't have that as part of his criminal restitution order. He asserts also that the Walmart purchases and ATM withdrawals were erroneously part of the restitution order, and he argues that the burden of proof was shifted from the prosecutor's office to him to prove that all those expenses were paid on her behalf to prove the proper use of funds. So the court then points to evidence where it says that he admitted to buying liquor, shoes, and taking her car to Minnesota with no ascertainable benefit to anyone other than himself. But they conclude that there's clear and convincing circumstantial evidence that Union spent a significant part of her money on himself, and he likely used cash to conceal the improper spending. But the court finds that the testimony lacked support to specifically support the restitution amount. Okay, this is where the court says, we know that this guy used money that he wasn't supposed to get. We don't want him left off the hook because the prosecutor can't prove it. How are we going to get that? This is where this case gets interesting. They find that the restitution order is supported by substantial, competent evidence when considering that he pled no contest to the well-pleaded facts of the charging document and the district court's finding of guilt due to his plea. So here, the crime he pleaded to requires that the accused misappropriated between $25,000 and no more than $100,000. By pleading no contest, the offender admitted to all the well-pleaded facts of the information for purposes of the case. The plea and the elements of the crime of conviction provided substantial confident evidence that at a minimum, because he pled no contest to this information that says he misappropriated at least $25,000, we can at least put $25,000 in the restitution order in damage or loss to Miller. So they take out the Riverland award. The district court orders Union to pay $23,000 and change, slightly less than the lower limit of the crime of conviction, and is therefore affirmed. So I thought that case was really interesting in the way that the Supreme Court got around getting that restitution order as part of his criminal conviction, even without evidence of where that money was spent. Okay, our last case is a C.R. Leggio versus Martin case. This is family law. So now we went from criminal to family law. We're all over the place here today. So Vincent and Miriam obtained a marriage license in February of 2019. They're married later that day. Vincent was 82 and Miriam was 52. Just let that sit there. 2 days before the marriage, Vincent was infused with fentanyl and Demerol, so his physician could search his upper bowels to determine the cause of his blood loss, dizziness, and general weaknesses. 2 days before his marriage. On the day of his marriage, this is long, but I thought it was interesting. The court found he was acutely ill, medically compromised, and could not have made prudent decisions. He was suffering from numerous medical conditions, including a seizure caused by blood infection, blood loss, dizziness, weakness, chronic anemia, difficulty breathing, fever, and the beginnings of liver failure. What a beautiful wedding day that is, isn't it? He was not receiving sufficient oxygen to his brain, and a doctor testified that his body was poisoning his brain for a period prior to the marriage. Vincent goes to the hospital, and he's woken up by his niece after his wedding day, and he says, I'm not married. And then when he was showed his marriage license with his signature on it, he was confused and said he was tricked. On June 21st of 2019, he commenced an action to dissolve or annul the marriage on the basis that he was incompetent at the time of the marriage. He passes away in August. Miriam files a motion to dismiss the annulment action for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, which was granted because he'd passed away. Less than a month later, the probate court appoints Steve Allison as administrator of the estate, and he moves to reopen the case and substitute the estate as the party plaintiff. That was also granted. The lower court finds that testimony during the case and the witness who performed the ceremony were without credit and not believable. The court found that the decedent was not competent to marry on the basis of overwhelming evidence. He did not possess the mental capacity to understand and comprehend the consequences of his marriage or to consent to the marriage. And the court rendered judgment annulling the marriage and then this appeal follows. The first point of appeal is subject matter jurisdiction. So again, little civil procedure moved into is whether or not the estate can jump in to a case that's ongoing. The relevant statute provides that a cause of action or right of action shall not be lost or destroyed by the death of any person. Both principles in equity and judicial precedent support the proposition that the administrator of an estate properly may maintain an annulment action initiated by the decedent plaintiff because they have to figure out how to administer this thing and whether or not this marriage is value and if Miriam gets the rights of a spouse. There is an exception, however, to the principle of standing. It's if the purpose of the case is defeated or rendered useless by the death of the party. Miriam claims it's useless because he's dead, so they can't be married anymore. The court disagrees in this case because Vincent, prior to his death, took the action to protect his assets by seeking exclusive possession of the premises to return personal items and to enjoin Miriam from collecting rent on his properties. They also find that because Vincent initiated that claim for annulment before he passed away, he didn't waive the voidable defect of his marriage, and the final ground was based on the standard of evidence that she waived during the hearings and deferred to the court's discretion. So the marriage is off. The right thing happened here. Hopefully Miriam gives up at this point because the evidence does not look good for her. Some elder law news before we get out of here. Indiana has made a final rule change to make the community spouse IRAs countable resources. In 2020, the Indiana Family and Social Services Administration was all set to make a rule change to make community spouse retirement accounts countable resources for Medicaid qualification. They paused that action in July of 2020, I'm assuming because of COVID. And then in July, they pushed those final rules through, which state the retirement account of either or both spouses have an ownership interest in or are included in the total value of resources. So if you're working in Indiana and you have to deal with the community spouse's IRA now, we do have solutions for you here at Krauss Financial to help speed up the Medicaid eligibility. Just a quick reminder, we talked about this last time, that there is no food reduction anymore for SSI for in-kind support and maintenance. That went into effect on September 20th of 2024. And then it was also announced earlier this month that the Social Security benefits and SSI COLA adjustment will just be 2.5% increase in 2025. We've been seeing, you know, I think at one point we had 8% COLA adjustment a couple of years ago. So much moderate adjustment upwards for the COLA adjustment for 2025. Another case we've been following that's tragic is the Gavone case where Leo Gavone and members of the foundation stole up to $143 million from special needs trusts that they were overseeing. There was a temporary injunction issued in the Attorney General case where they found some real property in Florida and Kentucky to recoup some of the funds up to $2 million. The Attorney General was going after a freeze on his personal assets. They were not part of that temporary injunction. And then in the bankruptcy case that kind of triggered all this is there was an issue for the bankruptcy case to pay their attorney's fees to Ackerman of over $600,000. So unfortunately, it looks like a lot of this money is going to go to attorney's fees rather than to the victims. And how this guy isn't in jail, I don't know, when we have our buddy Alonzo Union over there as part of a restitution order. I guess he didn't go to jail, but he's in the criminal side of things and these guys aren't. But anyways, we'll keep you up to date on what's going on there. And hopefully we get some good news that some of that money is coming back to some of those beneficiaries. Last but not least, with our last minute, if you haven't gotten enough election information, usually at this time of year, I'll try to do what happens if either candidate for president wins. But this time around, neither campaign has really released much in-depth policy position papers like they did the last few go-arounds that I've been doing these. However, KFF, which is formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, released a report. And what they did is they went, because kind of both of these candidates have already been in office in administrations, at least with Harris. And so they went back to the Trump administration, they looked at the Biden-Harris administration's historical budget and legislative proposals to kind of see what could be the effect to the Medicaid programs. That is linked on your interactive agenda if you want to look at that. Very good work, very thorough in there. And then earlier this month, kind of the only thing that has really got into any detail is the Harris campaign released a fact sheet. I don't really know what kind of bearing that has, where the proposal outlines, again, the importance of providing care at home, which has kind of been the Biden-Harris administration is we want to increase home and community-based services, whereas the Trump administration wants to do more block grants and limit the spending, as you would predict. But the kind of the twist here is that Harris fact sheet says they want to use Medicare as the funding source for that. Doesn't go into any detail more than that, but traditionally that has always been proposed under Medicaid. So home and community-based services as a Medicare benefit would be something new. It's a fact sheet. Who knows how far that's going to go, even if Harris wins the election. So if you want to take a look at that, there is some information out there that could be helpful if clients are asking you, well, what happens to my Medicaid if one person wins or the other? What we've traditionally seen is there hasn't been a lot of change to the long-term care programs, at least parts of Medicaid, through the last two administrations. Now, there has been proposals, but they never really got off the ground. So if you're worried about the election and want to read more about it, that is linked in your interactive agenda. If you want to learn more, please do sign up for our attorney access. You'll get those notifications. We have a basic membership that's free. You'll get notifications of all of our courses. Please do that. If you want to do some on-demand studying, we do have that as well. So feel free to sign up at krausfinancial.com. So I went a little bit over, 32 minutes. That should get you up to date on what's going on in elder law in the last few months, and then look forward to our next one in the first quarter of 2025. Have a great end of your year, great holiday season, and we'll see you in 2025. Thanks so much for attending, and we'll see you soon.